From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 286, recorded live Tuesday, September 26, 2011. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode of the Startup Series, Scott talks with Gail Froture, creator of PostSharp.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. And today, via the magic of Skype, from the other side of the world, we have Gail Froture from Sharp Crafters, creator of PostSharp. How are you, sir?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm happy to be talking to you. I'm a big fan. We have lots to talk about, but this is still part of the startup series, and I thought it would be great to talk to you because you're an open source person who's done software that I've used in the open source world, but now you also have a company built around that. So I want to understand that transition that you made, and then we'll talk a little bit about the product and what it does and what the future is. So start me out by just telling me what it is that you built.
So we built PostSharp, which is a post compiler or an aspect-oriented framework. So what it does is that it allows you as a developer to produce code with less boilerplate code. So when you think of a feature like implementing notify property change or undo redo, you always have to write the same three lines of code. So three lines of code is nothing, but it happens for every single property of every class. So this can turn into thousands of lines of code. And actually there is a better way to write code. It's to recognize that there is an implementation pattern there. And then so the tool we make so allows you to implement the design pattern so that the code is actually generated automatically and does not pollute your source code. So this is PostSharp and this is aspect-oriented programming.
So aspect-oriented programming, I've heard it referred to in the terms of cross-cutting concerns. Like people think about things vertically when creating object orientation, and this derives from that, and that derives from this other thing. But aspect-oriented programming, like logging, is used as an example. This is something that doesn't fit into the vertical hierarchy, but instead cuts across aspects of the entire application. Is that a good way to express that?
Yes, exactly. So the design principle in software engineering is the separation of concerns. So when we think of a feature, we would like to see a single artifact of implementation. For instance, when we think of customer management, we would like to see, say, a single namespace. Then when we go finder in the features, we go to finder artifacts like a class, a method, and so on. So what we want is a nice separation of concerns. But when we think about logging or transaction handling or exception handling, notify property change, undo redo, security, so we have these concerns that cross-cut all the business functions mm-hmm. of the program, and in object-oriented jargon, we call that cross-cutting concerns. So these are the features that are common to all the business features and that cannot be addressed vertically by classes, procedures, methods. And that's why, a team in Palo Alto started to think about this problem in 2001, and they came with the principles of aspect-oriented programming. And so there are very strong implementations in Java. And, PostSharp is the implementation, the strongest implementation in .NET. Mm. Not the only one, but the most comprehensive for Microsoft .NET.
When did you create this? Were you working on a project and you said to yourself, this is a need and I'm going to make it? And how did it become open source?
It started immediately as open source. I started with when I was a developer in a telecom company, and so I had to implement supervisioning processes, and I felt the need to do some more interesting code, more low level code. So I picked a problem, and I started playing with that. This was back in 2004. And after like 9 months or 1 year, so I did it every evening, 1 or 2 hours. And after 1 year, I noticed that people were interested in the product, and well, downloads started, conversations on the support forum started. So some companies wanted to sponsor the project to develop features that they would use. And so gradually it became much more and more important. And after, I think it was 3 years in 2007, then I decided to leave my full-time job at a telecom company and start as a freelancer. And the idea at the beginning was to devote 40% of my time to the open source project, so not being paid, and so to invoice to the customer 60% of that time, of the whole time. And so this balance worked during 2 years, and then the success continued to grow. And so 40% was not enough, so it was 50, 60. And at that point, well, I had to realize that it was not possible to make a living on just 40% of my time. So users were pushing for more support, more features, a stronger commercial foundation. So I decided to create a company on the existing product. And so what I did there is to contact a business angel with large experience in software startups. And I started working on a new version. So the open source version is still available now. It is still free. It is not supported anymore. So we did a new version with new features. And after 9 months, I think, of development and testing, we started selling this new version.
Okay, well, there's a couple of interesting things there. You've just shared us a lot of information. Let me start a little bit farther back. You had the open source project. It became quite popular. So you decided to quit your full-time job, do consulting, and then hope that the consulting would support your work on the open source project.
Yes.
Was your consulting exclusively in the area of aspect-oriented programming, or was it just general consulting?
It was connected to PostHarp itself. At the beginning, it was the main topic of the contract, and then I started working on different features that were not related to the product. So the open source project helped me to get visibility in the .NET community and to get better contracts that would allow me to work only 60% instead of 100. And I think that's something that's if you talk with open source contributors, they will tell you the same story. When you start contributing to a significant project, or you start a significant project on your own, you get huge visibility, and then you get opportunities that you would not get if you just follow the path that your manager has for you, or that you could achieve in your own local city.
But why? It seems like a very straightforward business that you're trying to make here. You have a project that's popular. It's open source. You have an engaged user base. So you'll consult part of the time and then work on your open source part of the time. But then you said it became 40%, 50%, 60%. Why was the work overwhelming the open source project? Why did the percentage go up like that?
Much of the work came from so supporting frameworks is an issue and creating new features. So when you start a project, I think that's, well, any project, when you don't have any user, then you don't have any legacy. It's very, well, easy to create the first lines of code. Mm-hmm. Then when you have users, anything you add to the project, well, has a quadratic cost. No, the marginal cost of implementing a feature is actually, well, a function of the legacy code base. That's something quite common in software development. So when the project became 3 years old and the user were counted in thousands, it started to require significant effort to support new frameworks like Silverlight. At this time was new. Mm-hmm. Windows Azure was new. There were specific requirements for the first versions of Windows Azure. And then companies developers start using the product in companies, and they want some kind of guarantee that the project will continue to be maintained in the future. And a commercial company seems a better guarantee for them. So there were both sources of pressure, the time and also the customers telling, we are waiting for a commercial version.
Okay, so that's where it starts getting interesting, because I think that a lot of the listeners are probably either involved in an open source project or they are interested in getting involved. We all know that it's easier to work on an open source project or at least get started than it is to find a job. So a number of people want to get experience or, as you said, to get visibility. They work on an open source project. But then when a project gets to a certain size or a certain popularity, enterprises and companies and large commercial entities demand more. They expect more. They want an organization behind it, whether it be, you know, like an Apache Foundation or a Outer Curve Foundation or Eclipse or an actual commercial entity. But when you transition between open source and commercial, don't you risk losing a lot of people? You might gain some, but you could also lose your base.
Yes, you are, when you make the transition, you are changing your audience. So indeed, we lost a lot of users, and we lost what's called the community karma during the first 6 months. But then we had to develop different strategies to get an audience and to recover and to gain the new audience. So it is risky. It is not a guaranteed success. But before doing the transition, there is something that, well, I tried unsuccessfully, but, well, some other people with open source projects did successfully. What I tried before is to try to sell support on the free product. And so during 6 months, there was a commercial version of the product with a commercial licensing, and that came with support. But actually, I sold 3-5 licenses. You know, it was not enough to make a living. So this was in 2008, I think, and there was a kind of belief in the community that when you do open source project, you can make a living out of support. And for me, it turned out to be wrong. And if you think about that, making a living out of support is a kind of lose-win situation. You are winning because your customer is losing. When your customer calls support, it probably means that he's frustrated, that he has had problem and needs help. I think developers don't like to contact support. So we are kinds of people who like to solve problems ourselves. Mm-hmm. So this is something that for me did not work. And what worked was to stop with the open source edition and tell to people, hey, we made investments in a new version. If you want to get the new features, it's going to be for a fee. And if you don't want, then you have two possibilities. You have the old version that was still available and is still for legacy users. Mm-hmm. And then there is the free edition. So we moved from an open source model to freemium edition and a professional edition.
Okay, so the old version is frozen in time, right? It's done. Has it been forked and moved in another direction, or is it simply finished?
No, it is finished. Some folks in the community made a copy in GitHub or any repository. But no one had taken over the code, and so this version is dead. But I think still I think up to 50% of people who are using PostShard every day still use the old version.
Mm. And then it will eventually die when something in the framework changes that it is simply unsupported and no one fixes it, I assume.
Yes. So it doesn't support .NET 4. So that means that there is still a large number of developers that work on the 3.5 stack.
Hi, this is Scott coming to you from another place in time. Are you using agile practices to manage your software development? There's lots of tools in the market that manage the steps of a project, but most of them focus on individual roles. Get ready for a solution that caters for the success of the whole team. The guys at Telerik introduced TeamPulse. It's an agile project management tool that'll help you gather ideas, estimate, plan, track progress in a common workspace. Finally, companies, regardless of their size, can use a lightweight and convenient tool that makes all the stakeholders work as a united team, even if they're in different countries. By combining intuitive user interface and the power of Silverlight, TeamPulse removes the roadblocks that you typically face in applying agile in an effective manner. No more lost data, no disparate systems, no lack of critical analytics regarding the health and velocity of your project. See for yourself. Get a free copy for 5 users and 1 project at Telerik.com/TeamPulse. And please do thank Telerik for supporting Hansel Minutes on their Facebook fan page, facebook.com/TELERIK, Telerik. We do appreciate it. There wouldn't be a Hansel Minutes if there wasn't Telerik helping us. What kind of an advice would you give to someone out there who's listening, who has open source, and they built something significant, and they start to think about, well, I've done all this free work, and I've got all this fame, but I don't have any money. Should every open source project, when it gets to a certain level of popularity, switch to commercial?
I don't think so, because I have seen different models working well. It's of course difficult to see if something works well commercially without knowing the internal numbers, and you will never know them. But so you can get a very high popularity, and thanks to your popularity, will become a so famous consultant. You can offer training. This can be a more profitable business model than turning commercial. Then if you turn commercial, you may have you may lose a part of your audience. Mm-hmm. For a part of your audience, you turn from a hero to a asshole, because it used to be free and now it's commercial, and there is a minority of people that will send you silly emails that you are not a good guy anymore. But this is a minority. This is maybe 5% of the users who will do the opposite and telling that this is the right move to do. So, should you move your open source project to commercial? I would say, it's not an obvious, obvious choice. First, think about the other strategies you have, and think about are you able to get contributors to your project? Because in case of PostSharp, it was so low level and so complex that I have not been able to get contributors in the project when I decided to switch to open source. So at that time, I was the author of 99.7% of the source code. Mm.
See, that's interesting because even simple projects and popular projects, basic things like Nerd Dinner, my silly little example, you know, we've had people contribute over the years, but in the last year, it's been me and John Galloway and two other very nice guys from the community, John Peterson and Peter Moorfield. And you would think I would have 30, 40, 50 people, you know, sending me code, but it just doesn't happen.
No.
And then if you turn up the difficulty, like something with an aspect-oriented project, you're making the pool of people that you can choose from smaller and smaller, and then you find yourself all alone with a project that has thousands and thousands of users.
Exactly. So there is a point where you have to realize that if you want the project to continue and just to be alive and to grow and to get adapted to the new features of the .NET platform at a minimum, then you need to pay people because the contributors will not come. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or you could find some kind of contributors that will tell you, well, give me a task and I will do that. And so you have to do nearly micromanagement and you are losing more time than you are gaining. So this was the situation in 2006, 2007. At the time where SwordForge was the hub of open source development.
How do you, when you transition from open source to commercial, do you close the source, and how do you do that?
So the way you close a source, actually you need to be the only contributor, because otherwise you don't have the right to do that. So you need the agreement of all contributors, and it's better if it's a small number, and then you can change the license, because, well, the copyright owners can change the license. So what I did is to create a new version based on the old version, of course, but with a different license. I consider doing a part of the project still in open source and doing the add-ins in closed source, but I was not able to find an architecture where the license would so that the commercial features will not be like cross-cutting to the free ones, and that there could be a separation of license in the separation of code. So that's a model that could work in some software. For instance, you can make an open source ERP and make commercial plugins, but in case of PostSharp, this was not possible.
Okay, well, let's spend a little time talking about PostSharp and what it does. We talked a little bit about aspect-oriented programming, but if I understand correctly, if there's anything that you want in your source to change the behavior of the entire application, like you said, security or logging or exception management, these are almost like plugins, but they don't plug in. Again, I use the term vertically in the sense that they don't plug into the hierarchy necessarily. They slice all the way through the application. Like you could turn on detailed logging in your application, but is it correct you can do it without changing the source? And really, you could do it without ever seeing it.
So in PostSharp version 2, which is the current version, it is principally based on custom attributes. So at least you need one custom attribute inside, for instance, your assembly info.cs. That's the minimum you need. There is a trick to do it without that, but it is not the way it is supposed to work. So in PostSharp 2, the system is designed to modify a program whose you have the source code. So not an arbitrary program. This is something that will change in PostSharp 3. We will allow for modification of whatever. Mm-hmm. But in PostSharp 2, it is designed as a development tool, not as a monitoring tool, which would let you to analyze whatever, like whatever code, for instance, SharePoint, without having the source code. So So PostSharp is very oriented to with custom attributes, but it doesn't mean that you need to add a custom attribute to every method you need to target. Typically, if you want to do logging of everything, you would put a custom attribute at the assembly level, a single custom attribute. And then you have filters, so you can see, you can say that you want to trace only public methods. Or you can do more complex things. You can use reflection at build time. This is quite cool because, well, PostSharp runs at build time, so just after the C# compiler. So you can write code that executes inside PostSharp, and so you can inspect the assembly using reflection, and you can add the aspects wherever it is relevant based on C# code. So you can do very, very fun stuff like you can do a link query over reflection that returns a set of aspects, for instance.
So help me understand where this fits into the process, because for most people, they write source, they run it through the compiler from the company that they bought the software from, like Microsoft. So they run it through Microsoft's compiler, and it makes IL, it makes intermediate language, and then that's the end of it. Where do you fit in?
So PostSharp runs just after the compiler. It reads the MSIL, it transforms it, and then it writes it back. So, conceptually, it can be understood as an extension of the compiler, but technically it runs as a post-compilation step, which is post-C#.
Okay, so it's post-compilation. So you're literally taking the binary, or what we think of as the binary, which is mm-hmm. really just this container full of IL. You open it up and you change the resulting code. You change the code that C# made.
Yes.
In injecting in your own IL, weaving in, as it were, your own IL. How can I then debug that?
So that's quite easy because, PostSharp rewrites the PDB file. When PostSharp injects instructions, it also injects sequence points, so it updates the mapping between the binary and the source code. So actually, when you debug that, it just works as usually. But you have the aspects there. So if you step into a method and there is an aspect on the method, you will get into the aspect. And then when the aspect will call, for instance, proceed. For instance, you make a caching aspect that intercepts the method. Mm-hmm. You are on the method. You click on step into. You get into the aspect. And then when the caching aspect calls proceed, because, the method is not cached and needs to be executed, mm-hmm. then you step into proceed and you get back into the method, and then you can step as usually.
So it's really seamless. I mean, I assume that if it broke anything, from the debugging experience, people would be less likely to use it. But you're saying I can hit F11 and go right into the aspect and it's just fine.
Yes, you can put breakpoints, as usually. If you don't want to step into an aspect every time because, you know it's there and you don't want to debug that, then you can use the custom attributes of the system.diagnostics namespace. For instance, mm-hmm. Debugger step through. And so step into will not step into the aspect.
Why would I want to use aspect-oriented programming as opposed to perhaps building in my own plugin model to using MEF to plug things into, to my application? Why would I pick aspect-oriented programming over designing my own model to inject code in or at least load code into, to my space?
So if you use a dependency injection framework, you are able to inject behaviors between the client and the service. So, because dependency injection works this way that the client requests an interface to the container, and the container normally returns the implementation. But, the container, if there is an aspect on the implementation or on the service, he would he would return a proxy, and the proxy would call them up the well logging and so on. But that means that you are limited to to adding behaviors to just to the communication between a client and a service. It means not to private methods, not to static methods, not to WPF controls. So the set of points to which you can add aspects is actually pretty limited.
Mm. And is this something that I should be concerned about as a developer, or are aspects meant to just simply fade into the background and that I'll simply forget that they're there? I mean, I guess I would be concerned that something would happen that I would be unable to debug.
You know, when we talk with long-time customers, so people who have been using Postgre for 3-4 years, they tell me the main benefit is not the number of lines of code that you decrease. The main benefit is that the knowledge required by a new team member is lower. So they have new team members who don't understand aspect-oriented programming, don't need to understand what is an aspect, and it's only after 6 to 9 months that they ask, hey, how was transaction handling so implemented anyway? Because it's not in the code, it just happens magically. So, but so during these 6-9 months, the new team member was able to do good code without requiring large learning of, you know, multi-threading, caching, transaction handling. It was just there. So the architect just put the aspects on the business objects and, well, told, I want to trace this. This needs to be transactional. So it can be a real benefit that you don't need to know that the aspects is there.
It's interesting because it's another kind of abstraction. I was going to say another layer of abstraction, but it's another kind of abstraction. And I think that abstractions are the whole point of what the computer is supposed to be doing. It's supposed to do the work for you that's not fun. And, you know, logging is no fun. And transactions are no fun. So why not hide that? Do you have any thoughts on why aspect-oriented programming hasn't, you know, taken the world by fire? Like, why everyone isn't using it?
I think one of the reasons was that it has been designed by academic researchers at the Xerox Palo Alto laboratory. And the first implementations were very academic with very, I think, cumbersome concepts. So that the learning curve was very, very steep at the beginning. And so when I started to design Postgre in 2004 or 2005, I looked at that stuff and, well, I told to myself, because I've been programming since the age of 11. So I had kind of, well, programmer's mind before being an engineer. So I told to myself that's not the way that should be done, because in .NET we have custom attributes. We can make this much more natural for programmers to use without introducing new concepts. Mm-hmm. And so I designed a very lightweight version of aspect-oriented programming that was called LAOS, Lightweight Aspect-Oriented System. And this started to be popular, this version, not the complex one that existed back then, for instance, Aspect DNG or so Aspect Sharp and all the Aspect J clones. Mm-hmm. This simple version became popular. So I think there was a communication problem at the beginning, so that many people got maybe burned by the complexity. Mm-hmm. But now, if I look at the industry that are our best customers or more frequent one, it's actually not the software development industry. That this is finance and healthcare. So people doing business software. This is where AOP is the most useful.
Right. Big, you know, enterprises where the work needs to get done and there are cross-cutting concerns that can be created by the architect or another group, so that, yes, the business person can focus on the business problem.
Exactly.
And the other issues can be handled by the software.
Exactly.
Well, thank you so much for chatting with me today. Folks can go up to sharpcrafters.com and you can download the free starter edition of PostSharp and check it out. It's a pretty amazing piece of software. And if you look there on the homepage, you've got folks like Allende from Then Hibernate singing its praises. So I would encourage you to check out PostSharp. And thanks so much, Gail Fratturo, for coming on the show and talking about your startup.
Thank you, Scott.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.